Welcome to Oncology Nursing Update, understanding current paradigms and new approaches in the care of patients with prostate cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Ms. Kathleen Burns from the City of Hope Comprehensive Cancer Center in Duarte, California, to discuss nursing considerations in patients with prostate cancer. To begin, I asked her about a 73-year-old man in her practice with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer who'd been receiving testosterone supplementation prior to the diagnosis. This man, when he first presented, was found to have metastatic disease. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
And and he actually ended up coming in for treatment. He had like a PSA or he was having some kind of symptoms, you know, initially.
He was not having any symptoms anymore. I believe he had the PSA because he had testosterone supplementation for years and he was being monitored for that.
Why was he taking it? And from his point of view, how did it benefit him?
He did not admit to hypogonadism. And it's interesting, I guess up to about 3% of men are treated without the actual clinical diagnosis.
And from his point of view, is he gaining benefit? Did he feel better? Did he think it was helping him?
He did. Yeah, he stayed on it for years, actually. Yeah.
And what was his background? What kind of work did he do? And talk a little bit about him.
I would believe he was an engineering type. I don't know for sure. He was, once I met him, he was already retired, but very interested in details in education.
And did he have a partner or wife or children?
He had a wife and kids, but they never came in with him.
So he always came alone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious. It sounds like he, you know, has a little bit of background or education. Did he ever express to you any concerns that maybe there was a link between him taking testosterone and getting prostate cancer?
He did not. And officially, if you're diagnosed with hypogonadism, there is no link with increased prostate cancer.
Right. So he comes in and he doesn't really have any symptoms, it sounds like, no bone pain or anything. And then
Correct.
On the imaging workup, basically he's found to have metastatic disease. So what was his reaction to being diagnosed with prostate cancer and in particular to be diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer?
Mm-hmm. I think it was a huge shock at the beginning and he very much resisted sort of the guideline-driven treatment. He was very, very interested in doing a radical prostatectomy.
So he ended up, even though he had metastatic disease, he had a prostatectomy. So at one point, it sounds like he got started on ADT. I think it was Relugolix. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. He actually, right around that time, he started on the combination, Relugolix and apalutamide.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you discussed with him at that point when you were about to start the Relugolix and the apalutamide. Okay. So how did you explain to him what Relugolix is and what to expect?
Of course. So Relugolix is the only oral anti-androgen therapy on the market currently. So it is a once-a-day pill, which in general for many guys is much easier to take than an injection that they would need to have in the clinic. He was at the time very motivated to take ADT because he had had a surgery and when they analyzed his prostate cancer, it was a neuroendocrine differentiation, which puts him in a higher risk category. So at that point, even though he had been hesitant to start on ADT, he knew it was absolutely necessary in his case. So that turned that fear into much more motivation for him.
How did you explain to him how Relugolix and ADT in general works? Like what the mechanism is and what to expect in terms of side effects and toxicity?
Okay. So androgen deprivation essentially turns off the production of testosterone, which the way I explain it to patients is it can then sort of starve the prostate cancer. So it's not the only mechanism for growth in prostate cancer, but it can turn it down and generally can turn that PSA increase to the opposite direction. Side effects for low testosterone are not different when you look at the other methods of giving ADT. So the pill works in a very similar way to, say, a Leuprolide injection. Mechanistically, it works a little bit different, but the effects and the side effects are the same. So men on ADT are going to experience fatigue, low libido, hot flashes, potentially mood changes, and that usually means they're a little more emotional, a little more excitable, muscle loss, bone loss. So these are, it's a long conversation when these patients are started on these medications. Some things happen fairly quickly and some things happen over time.
I imagine he might have asked, what can I do to prevent this, or what can you do to minimize the kind of symptoms? What kinds of things can be done?
We generally say that exercise is the number one intervention for many of the side effects from ADT. So exercise will improve your mood, will moderate your bone loss, muscle loss. So that's our number one intervention. Of course, there are some supportive interventions for hot flashes and for the cognitive changes. Men generally say that they're a little slower to come up with the answer than they were previously.
What was this man's baseline level of exercise, and what type of sexual activity was he having?
He was sexually active at the time. His exercise had changed when he had developed some angina while hiking. So that made it a little more complicated for him, because he had that fear of cardiac events that made him a little hesitant to do his typical exercise plan.
So what happened once he started on the relugolix? What kind of issues came up, if any?
He actually tolerated it extremely well. And at the time, we added apalutamide, which is an androgen receptor inhibitor. So it works together with the relugolix. So he really tolerated it extremely well. Typically, what we watch for with both of those is thyroid function changes and sometimes a fairly significant skin rash. And neither of those he had. So in general, it was really for him just monitoring the side effects of low testosterone.
And did he, I don't know whether he reported to you, did he continue to have sexual activity and libido and sexual function?
He was challenged by lack of interest, but he did reach out to us a couple times, and we talked about, some other options other than intercourse that might kind of please he and his wife as well.
So you mentioned the fact that in addition to having androgen deprivation therapy, or ADT, he also received apalutamide. You mentioned that it's an androgen receptor blocker. I recently heard people describe these agents as lutamides because they all end in lutamide. I kind of like that better. But, we have, he got apalutamide. We also have enzalutamide, and we also have darolutamide, three very well studied and approved, you can call them androgen blockers. Could you kind of talk a little bit about, what you say to patients about to begin one of these agents? And sort of how your discussion differs based on which agent. He got apalutamide, but if he was getting enza or dara, would you approach it differently? And what are some of the things you bring up to patients?
Yeah, of course. They do follow a similar pathway, but the side effect profile for the three of them can be very different. Enzalutamide was the first one, and because it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it can result in some changes, a little more cognitive issues, and a few more falls and fractures. Apalutamide seems to be a very tolerable drug, but it still requires a little additional monitoring in terms of thyroid function and this sort of skin rash that comes on fairly quickly. So it can require some titration at times. There is also a drug-to-drug interaction between relugolix and apalutamide. The interaction is that the testosterone gets metabolized more quickly, so it's not always completely suppressed. But the good news about that is we check testosterone every time, so we would be able to anticipate that really easily.
So how long has he been on treatment now, and how's he feeling?
Yeah, so he's been on treatment now for almost, just about 2 years. Doing well, PSA is down, feeling well, and still really trying to kind of maintain that level activity that he needs to do while he keeps an eye on his heart health.
So, you know, he has what's, I guess, commonly called hormone-sensitive metastatic prostate cancer because he's never been treated with any type of hormone, and he has a metastatic disease. He has, I guess, what we call de novo metastatic disease, and that he presented at first diagnosis. A lot of other men will have had prior treatment with localized therapy, radiation therapy, or surgery, and then later on, usually we'll get a PSA rise and then metastatic disease. So sort of two different paths to arrive at the same place. I guess in the past, these patients would get androgen deprivation therapy, and then if and when, and usually they would progress at some point, then would get some other type of hormonal therapy, such as these lutamines that we just talked about. But it seems that in recent years, now there's been a major shift towards, you know, intensifying the endocrine therapy. So not just giving ADT alone, but adding, for example, a lutamide, also abiraterone is another endocrine-based agent. So can you talk a little bit what you say to patients who are going to begin abiraterone and prednisone, and how does that experience compare to a patient who's going to get one of these lutamides?
Of course. Abiraterone has been around for a long time now, probably 9 years, 10 years. It does work very differently. It's a different class of drugs, although it does work in a similar indication. Abiraterone, however, kind of goes after the adrenal glands and turns off the bit of testosterone that the adrenal glands produce. So it sort of squeezes out that last bit of testosterone. The challenge with that is it requires prednisone to replace the cortisol produced by the adrenal glands. And so it's a little more complicated protocol, also pretty well tolerated, but they do require a little more monitoring in terms of labs. We watch them closely for liver toxicity, potassium depletion, et cetera.
I know you're just trying to replace the normal body steroids. Do you see, you know, effects of cortisone? For example, in patients with diabetes, does it usually get worse, or is not enough steroids for that?
It can. So you're absolutely right that it's really just replacement. But I think the two most distressing side effects that patients talk to me about is one, a little more difficulty in managing their blood sugar, although that can be attributed to with, you know, having low testosterone changes your insulin sensitivity and increases insulin resistance. On the other hand, they do complain of easy bruising and easy skin tears. And for these guys, that might be the only ones side effect other than weight gain that might be obvious to other people, right? So that can be a very distressing problem for them to have a lot of bruises on their arms.
So I guess the other issue here is, you know, in prostate cancer, you have one of the best, if not the best, tumor marker in oncology, as we mentioned, the PSA. You mentioned that this man, his PSA, you know, dramatically decreased, or I don't know, maybe even went away. Although, of course, that doesn't mean the cancer went away. I'm curious how you see men responding to PSA. You mentioned this man was an engineer. I've heard stories about people bringing in plots to their PSA and getting all very, very nervous about it. I think it's called PSA anxiety or something. Mm-hmm. What are the variations of that that you observed, and how fixated was he on his PSA?
He was not as fixated as others. He also understood that when they took his prostate out and they tested the cells in the prostate, he did have a bit of a conversion, which makes his prostate cancer a little more aggressive than others. And two, it doesn't secrete quite as much PSA as an adenocarcinoma would. So he actually had more scan anxiety. So a little more scan anxiety because he knew that was sort of the proof of the pudding of where his cancer was. We do use PSA for anyone who is neuroendocrine, but we also look at other markers as well.
So one more thing before we get into PSA-only disease or relapse, which is, again, going back to these lutamides, you know, I don't think there's any trials comparing them to see, you know, whether it's less toxic or more. It looks indirectly, they look like the efficacy is pretty similar. But as you mentioned, maybe a different in side effect profile. Any sense about which one or you all or people in general choose? I've heard people say darolutamide is the best tolerated and they like that. But what's your take?
We use all four. I think it's more of a process of exclusion. Like, for example, if someone had a history of seizures or was frail with falls and fractures, I would avoid enzalutamide and look elsewhere at that point. We do feel that people feel pretty well on the abiraterone prednisone combination, but we use it probably, like we talked about, with a little more caution with someone who is diabetic. Sometimes cost is an issue. These medicines can be very expensive, so it can take a bit to find financial assistance and coverage. Generally, they're all covered, but some seem to have a little bit more challenge with that, I would say.
Let's talk to you a little bit about this PSA-only disease that we see in men who've had prior local therapy. They're followed very closely and have, you know, serial PSA measurements, and often, if they are followed carefully, get picked up at a point where they only have that and the scans are negative. And we know in that situation, if their PSA is increasing rapidly, that they're very likely to develop metastatic disease in the near future. And those subset of patients will often get treated. In the past, they would get ADT alone. And just like we just said with metastatic disease, what they saw is same thing in breast cancer, when they intensified the endocrine therapy, they got better results. And so we went through a stage where that was done. But then a couple years ago, a really amazing trial came out, the EMBARK study. This is one of my favorite studies in all of oncology. It was really amazing. And this was in men who had PSA-only disease. So they had a rapidly rising PSA, but the scans, and of course in those days, they didn't have the PSMA scan when the trial was done, which is much more sensitive. But in any event, they took these men and they randomized them to receive either ADT, which had been the standard for forever alone, just androgen deprivation, to androgen deprivation plus one of the lutamide. In this case, it was enzalutamide. But then amazingly, they also had a third arm that they randomized who just got enzalutamide alone with not ADT, which is something we really hardly ever did before. So it was really, you know, very, exciting to see them do that. And the other thing that they did was that all the patients got treatment intermittently as opposed to continuously as we do in metastatic disease. And the study, you know, very dramatic. As in, again, when you added the enzalutamide in, much better effect. But also, just using enzalutamide alone was surprisingly effective. It was actually more effective than ADT. So now it's been a couple of years since we saw the data. Now it's been approved, and now people are out there trying to do that. So I'm curious, first of all, can you talk a little bit about this idea of intermittent therapy? I remember at ONS you talked a little bit about it. Like, what exactly do you do when you have a patient who has a PSA that's high, doubling, you know, quickly, nothing on imaging? You start them on therapy, for example, let's say, in this case, the best treatment was enzalutamide plus ADT. Mm-hmm. Usually the PSA comes down in almost everybody, but then what?
Yeah, this is a really important point for nurses. I think I spend a lot of my time sort of managing expectations around what happens to PSA. Do you decide on a time, or is there a little more kind of flexibility to it? So in the EMBARK trial, yes, they got treated for 9 months and then came off. So there is some, I guess, conversation about the balance between if they're on an ADT, how are they tolerating it? So there's no specific black and white algorithm outside of the EMBARK trial. If you're looking at someone who's going to go on intermittent ADT, it's a combination of how well they tolerate it, how well it works. You know, we're going for durability. We'd love for men to go on it, tolerate it well, and when we decide to take them off, that they get a nice long time without treatment and with testosterone, because we know how healthy it is for men to have that testosterone for their, again, their mood, their bones, their heart, muscles, and health in general. So it can be a little frustrating that we're not really presenting them with a, you know, you're going to start it on January 1, you'll be off. So if we're really doing intermittent treatment outside of EMBARK, it does become a conversation and a little bit of a negotiation.
But it is very different. And I guess we should also say that when you stop the treatment, ADT, ADT, enzalutamide, whatever it is, you continue to monitor them. And then if at some point, if the PSA starts coming back up, particularly rapidly, you may restart the therapy, which is why it's called intermittent.
That piece is really critical for nurses in terms of men's expectations, because when they go off of it, we would love for it to stay down regardless of testosterone recovery, but we do expect for it to return. And what do you do when it returns? So if someone's gone from an undetectable PSA and now they're on surveillance and it comes up, they may have a long time before it gets even to the point where we could do a PET scan, which might be 0.4, 0.5 PSA. So that time is really critical in terms of education expectations.
So, because the whole point of intermittent therapy is to give the patient a break from some of the symptoms that you described. What do you see when you stop a treatment? Do you see them improve from a symptom point of view? And how long does it usually take to occur?
So it's been proven when you're taking either Degerlix, which is the injectable version of Relugolix, they have a faster testosterone recovery. So we generally see recovery within a month or so. The injectables, Leuprolide, for example, may take longer. It does take longer depending on if they're older or if they've been on it for a longer period of time. So that's an important piece. One other important misunderstanding is for patients who've had their definitive treatment, either radiation or the removal of the prostate, if they don't have a prostate, they should have no PSA. If they do have a prostate, the normal PSA for them is nadir after radiation plus 2. So they do have some room for having a PSA.
Yeah, that's a great point. The other thing I'm curious about in terms of this issue of so-called hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, where nowadays standard of care is androgen deprivation therapy plus something else, abiraterone or one of the lutamides. But the other potential thing that is considered in addition to both of those approaches or both of those therapies is chemotherapy or docetaxel. And, there's a lot of discussion and debate about who this should be offered to. I've heard people say, it's usually for younger people with a lot more disease. But I'm just kind of curious, at your place, how you decide whether to add, on top of everything else, chemotherapy when they're presenting with hormone-sensitive mets.
Yeah, it tends to be a long conversation. I think chemotherapy is one of the treatments, really one of the few treatments in prostate cancer where there's a real outward appearance change, right? So there's hair loss and skin changes and all. So it has to be a very motivated patient. I do work at a cancer research hospital. So after 10 years here, I can truly say that our patients are self-selected for wanting cutting-edge, more aggressive treatments in general.
All right, let's move on now and talk about your second case. So you got proton B therapy primarily. Then he had PSA rise, which is we just discussed. You brought up ADT, but he's reluctant to do it. He got bicalutamide for a PSA-only disease. Then he became resistant, and you started cipuleucel T. And then he had, I guess, progression. You got more endocrine therapy. You got some kind of intralesional thing. Yeah. But I guess at this point, did he have metastatic disease?
He had lymph nodes, I think, that would kind of pop up. So in 2020, right. He had a lymph node. He had some radiation. He always sort of got anxious halfway through and didn't complete treatments at times. So we sort of played...
But the bottom line was he was getting ADT. It looked like he got abiraterone as well. Mm-hmm. And then in 2022, he got olaparib.
Correct.
And how long was he on, or is he still on it?
He tried the combination. He dropped his hemoglobin, which is a pretty common side effect on a PARP. He came in with a hemoglobin of 6.5. So we took him off the olaparib, transfused him that day. His hemoglobin popped back up. So we dose reduced and resumed olaparib. He wasn't feeling great at the time. So we dropped the olaparib, tried the abiraterone, and then dropped the abiraterone at a point
Can you just talk a little bit about him as a person? What is did he have family members? Did he, anybody come with him to clinic? What kind of work he did? Maybe paint a little picture about him.
Yeah, he's an artist and an author, and has a very strong and supportive partner. So the partner would come up most of his appointments. He had a long drive to us, probably an hour, hour and a half. So we usually saw them together. A lot of his decisions and his concerns were really driven by a kind of a long-term anxiety disorder.
And how did he react to having prostate cancer, particularly metastatic disease?
Incredibly afraid of it. It took us a long time to convince him to adopt whatever that next step would be. A lot of conversation, a lot of pushback. He always had psychology support in his community, but there was a point where it was really accelerating. So we added psychology support through our hospital as well.
Did he find that helpful?
He did, yeah.
So I guess somewhere along the line, it was discovered that he had a BRCA2 germline mutation. So this is not somatic that's only in the tumor. This is germline, which of course would have implications for family members. Did he have any family history of breast cancer or prostate cancer? And did he have children or other immediate relatives?
No, actually had no family history and no children.
I guess typically in a situation like that, a patient with a germline mutation, usually it's going to be BRCA2 like him, mm-hmm. would see a genetic counselor to decide whether or not to, you know, offer testing to immediate relatives and potentially do preventive maneuvers, you know, in women with BRCA, potentially to have their ovaries and breasts removed, for example, men to maybe follow very carefully, for example. I'm just kind of curious, again, I see he didn't have any family, but when you do genetic counseling, do you ever use like online genetic counselors? Any thoughts about that? To me, it seemed like that made a lot of sense, but I don't know. Any thoughts?
Well, I work at City of Hope, which has a fairly large and well-known genetic department. So I think the closest we get to that is some of our practitioners will see a patient through telehealth, especially if it's a family who's out of state. So most of our appointments are in person.
So let's get back to the point at which he actually got treated with a PARP inhibitor. You said he was an artist, so I don't know how interested he was in some of the issues there, but what did you explain to him about what a PARP inhibitor is, like olaparib, and how it works?
Yeah, so PARP inhibitors are very different from most of our prostate cancer treatments. We adopted the use of PARPs from Women's Health. So our experience is we don't use it that often. You have to have certain genetic mutations prior to use. And in general, they're very tolerable. Generally, we keep a very close watch on the hemoglobin as it can drop fairly quickly. But on the other side, it tends to resolve fairly quickly with a slightly lower dose on the pill. Some fatigue, some weight gain, which is common in prostate cancer as well. And then these GI side effects seem to come in sort of a constellation of things. It's some taste changes, some nausea, and we watch them pretty closely because that's not an issue generally in our prostate world. Appetite is usually great. So we watch that closely, and really, if we see weight loss, it's a really quick nutrition referral.
From your point of view, what were those three therapies doing to him?
He had some fatigue overall. His exercise, he has a horse, so he was horseback riding for exercise. He had fatigue in general, lack of sleep, nutrition problems for sure. And for some reason, that combination, and it may not have even been related to those medications he was on, his anxiety seemed to be escalating. We had made some slight changes to the doses and the pills we were trying. We also increased his psychology support. He was also taking a lot of supplements, and we really did a deep dive into what do you need, what can we get rid of at that point. So we probably brought him down from, I don't know, 12 or 15 different pills to maybe six.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So in terms of the olaparib, and, you know, also we have telazoparib. Do you ever use that? Mm-hmm.
Yes, we do. Yep.
Any difference in tolerability issues, telazoparib and olaparib? And also, I don't know, do you use anything else like niraparib or anything else?
We've been studying talazoparib in a triplet form for about 3 years. That clinical trial seems to be where we treat most often, and it seems to be very tolerable.
So
not as strong nutritional issues.
So getting back to him and the olaparib, and again, now a lot of these people are getting it with abiraterone because I think that's where it's approved, although maybe that's going to change in the future. You know, we have a lot of experience in oncology with PARP inhibitors, strictly from ovarian cancer. And one issue that you hear talked about a lot in all the PARP inhibitors are GI toxicity. Like, what do you see, and what did you see in him?
Yeah, his taste changed significantly. So he found that he really had no appetite, which then feeds into the fatigue, and fatigue kind of feeds into more sleep during the day, less at night. So it's a bit of a spiral. So even though we had taken care of him for years and years, it was time for him to spend a little extra time with our nutrition team and really do a deep dive in right in the supplements, how he's eating, what he's eating. With all those side effects he was experiencing, I think the quality of the food was really downgraded. He was just kind of eating what he could at the time. So quite a bit of education was on what are his targets, how many fruits and vegetables, how much protein. And things really turned around for him with more education.
Another issue that sometimes comes up with PARP inhibitors is cytopenias. And with olaparib, you hear a little bit about anemia, even occasionally patients needing transfusions. Did he have any issues with cytopenias, and what have you observed in that regard?
He was chugging along pretty well on that combination of abiraterone and olaparib, but he came in one day, and he hadn't called this before, but when he came in, he was in a wheelchair, which was really unusual for him, and he had no energy at all. So it wasn't a surprise when we saw his labs. His hemoglobin had dropped from the 11 range to 6.5. So it was an abrupt change. We were seeing him every 4 weeks, and it was an abrupt change. And for him, it was very startling. Although we had talked about it, he had never had a blood transfusion, and that's a huge surprise because it drops quickly.
And any other need for transfusion, or just that one instance?
Nope, just that one time. And we dropped him to 200, and it popped right back up, no problem.
Anything else you want to say about the patient or what it's been like taking care of him?
A person that you get very used to and very comfortable with, I think we often forget that sometimes bringing in a different team and a different perspective can be really, really helpful. So just because we had been taking care of him for, 15 years, when those nutritional things happened, I thought it was really revealing to us that he probably needed other referrals outside of our team, which he has become very dependent on, to help him understand his challenges.
So let's go into your last case here. So he's a 75-year-old man with a long history of treatment for metastatic disease, got a lot of the therapies we've been talking about. Genomic testing was negative, so PARP inhibitors weren't really a consideration. But he did have a positive PSMA and was treated with lutetium 177. So I want to hear a little bit about, again, you know, what you discussed with him at that point in terms of what lutetium is and what to expect from it. But can you first provide a little bit of a background about him and, you know, his life?
He was a very gentle, soft-spoken man with a very supportive family. However, he lived a couple hours away from us. He spoke only Armenian. His wife did his translating for him. His wife was the primary caretaker and the holder of his insurance. So she had to work. She worked at a local Walmart in their town. He had two children. that were helpful close to home, but didn't come to his appointments. So we struggled with trying to help them understand what lutetium was as a treatment, because it does require 3 days of isolation, or at least distancing from children, young children. So that education piece was hard. He didn't like using a translator, which was a bit of a communication challenge for us in the office. He would generally call his wife at work and we would talk through her, which is always a challenge, right? He had osteoporosis. He was a very frail person, and we supported him a lot in with his pain. He ultimately had a fracture with a fall and was on some heavy narcotics. And his only way to get to our clinic sometime was for him to drive. So there was a lot going on with him, even to get him through the first treatment.
Yeah, that does sound very challenging. So, you know, this is a very different type of therapy. I mean, most people probably haven't heard of it in their patients. What did you explain to him in terms of exactly what it is and how it works?
Yeah. So this is a targeted agent. It's a radionuclide, which is linked to an agent that will take the molecule to an area of PSMA. So PSMA is prostate-specific membrane antigen, different than PSA. About 80% of our men are PSMA avid, so they could qualify for this treatment. So it's a very small, short infusion, radioactive infusion that goes in. It's excreted through the urine, and the patient is radioactive enough where when they go home for those first 3 days, they need to stay about 6 feet apart from other people. If they were to have to fly, they would probably set off radiation detectors. So for some people, that 3 days of isolation is difficult. First, watch out for young children, pets, things like that. And it's given every 6 weeks.
So I know that usually you don't see any problem with blood counts. It looks like he actually had a problem with blood counts. Mm-hmm. It kind of limited what you were able to do. But it also looks like he also responded. The tumor was benefiting. Was that your take?
Right, right. So that was the hard part, is he had such a good response in terms of his PSA. But the problem was, because he was so heavily pretreated, when he started, we generally use lab criteria from the vision trial, and he did qualify for that first treatment with a hemoglobin of 9.5 and a platelets of 75, I believe. But his counts then dropped pretty rapidly, I think, based on that heavy pretreatment that he had, and he had some bone marrow infiltration with his prostate cancer as well. So the problem was, we couldn't give any further doses of lutetium 177. And that kind of pushed him into this category of being transfusion dependent.
This targeted therapy, you know, makes a lot of sense. And, you know, the trials show that most patients benefited, at least in the trial. What's your experience been clinically? Do you find most patients have drops in PSA and, you know, improve from a tumor point of view, or not the minority do?
Yeah, I think many people either see a drop in PSA, although that's not one of the outcomes of the trial. So it's not always that the PSA drops, but many people do get a big improvement in their pain and their strength. They don't always go hand in hand. But I think what we've learned about this drug is the expectation that guys can go through all of them on schedule, it can be very unrealistic. We really try and kind of take a look at them each time they come in and make sure it's the right time and the right drug for them.
So I also wanted to ask you about another radionucleotide, but this, of course, lutetium, you know, it doesn't matter where the mets are, but there's another one that was actually developed before lutetium, radium, mm-hmm. and that, because of the way it works, is only for patients who have just bone mets. But can you explain how radium actually works, why it's only given to patients with bone mets, and again, what you see in terms of how they tolerate that?
Yeah, the big difference between lutetium 177 and radium 223 is that radium, the radioisotope, is attached to a molecule that acts like calcium and takes the radioisotope to the bone. So if you were trying to treat soft tissue, it's just not effective at all. It's given every 4 weeks. It can be given in the right indication with enzalutamide. And it's a little more tolerated, I would say, in that the counts don't drop quite as much.
Have you seen patients actually benefit the way you described for lutetium?
Absolutely, yes. In general, the one side effect I see most commonly with radium-223 is moderately loose stool. So it's pretty easy to tolerate, and it can significantly help pain as well.
So I guess, you know, one of the issues here in terms of quality of life and toxicity is comparing it to chemotherapy. With lutetium, we have the ability to give it before patients get chemotherapy. How much of an advantage is that? And, you know, kind of gets into the issue, how do men, typically men who, like this man's been through a lot, but may have a lot of metastatic disease, et cetera. What's the quality of life like that you see in patients who are getting chemo, like docetaxel, and how does it compare to the quality of life when they're getting these radionucleotides?
You know, we have a lot of experience with chemotherapy in general. So I think with chemotherapy, we have a little more room to dose change, both with scheduling and titrating based on counts. I don't think we're at that point with the radioisotopes at this point where we can get that creative, right, with knowing if we were to delay lutetium or drop the dose at all, if it would improve things. I think that's the part we're still learning. So chemotherapy, if you have a patient who's got really low counts, but they really, really want treatment, it can often be more of an option for them.
I guess also you mentioned before the issue of some patients have tumor in their bone marrow and that causes cytopenias. And then if you treat it successfully, actually their counts should get better theoretically if you have an effective agent.
Absolutely.
So a final question, you know, I've always been interested in self-satisfaction or work satisfaction and burnout and all that. I'm just curious what it's like working in the clinic you do. I mean, you're a very unusual situation seeing men in a tertiary research center with prostate cancer. These cases that you've described are all complicated and also interesting and different. I'm curious, you know, if somebody were to say, what is it that you like about working and focusing on GU oncology and prostate cancer in particular? What in particular do you find gratifying?
You know, probably the most gratifying piece for me is that I've done this for 30 years or more now, and I like the variety. You know, especially in prostate cancer, you get newly diagnosed, end stage. You know, and it's very collaborative in terms of radiation, surgery. For me, it's been a great kind of combination of all the things I've done prior to here, which included education, chemotherapy, radiation. So it keeps me on my toes. It's very challenging. The clinical trials that we do and the hope that we can see from some of these newer treatments just makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah, the clinical research, particularly all the new trials that are coming out, some of the things that we've talked about today and a lot more. I guess the other thing that I sort of was reflecting on listening to your cases is that it seems like it's not uncommon in prostate cancer to work with a man and his family for quite a period of time, even if they have metastatic disease. I mean, you don't see that too often in pancreatic cancer and a lot of other solid tumors. You see it in breast cancer where, you know, you have a patient who has a very serious situation, requires a lot of care, but then it goes on for 2, 3 or more years. I guess that gets to be a very different experience from your point of view as well.
Absolutely.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Nursing Update.